It's good to be together tonight. We're grateful for everyone who's assembled. We're going to be continuing our study of the book of Esther tonight. If you want to open up to Esther chapter 3, we're going to do a brief review and get into our text for tonight. This continues just to be a book that has fascinated me for a while, and I'm grateful that we get to study it together in this setting. Esther, again, as we noted last week, one of the notable things about the book is that it never mentions the name of God, but God's fingerprints are all over this story, and God is the centerpiece, really, of this story, even though his name is never specifically mentioned. Well, we mentioned last week just briefly that we don't know exactly who wrote the book of Esther, though it was likely written by someone around that time, possibly Mordecai or someone of that nature. And that Esther is one of the most disputed books of the Bible because it doesn't mention God's name, and it has to do with this Feast of Purim, which is not mentioned in the Law of Moses. But of course, as we go through, we're going to see God all over this book and see his deliverance of his people. And you'll remember, as we talked about last week, that Israel is in has been in captivity, though they've started to come back to the land. You remember they came back in three waves with Zerubbabel rebuilding the temple, Haggai and Zechariah helping to instigate that and give them some much-needed encouragement. Ezra has not yet come back to teach the law, and Nehemiah, of course, as we've studied recently, has not yet come back to rebuild the walls. But this fits between Ezra chapter 6, Ezra chapter 7, in the Persian Empire. And again, there is a sense in which we're a little bit distant from the culture of this book, and it's just, I think, helpful for us to try to step back into that time, to think about just what it would have been like to have been in a type of government, a type of society where what the emperor says goes. I mean, that's it. And because so much of this has to do with Ahasuerus or Xerxes, his Greek name, and all those dealings. So in Esther chapter 1, we had his banquet and Vashti's refusal. That, of course, it's going to be interesting as we go through and to see Ahasuerus' personality as we go through. And some of this, again, is not completely 100% like, okay, like this is the way it has to be, but we can infer some things about his personality as we go through. And one of those things is that he's just trying to make this show. In chapter 1, he calls Vashti, the queen, to show herself off. We don't know in what exact nature that was, but basically she was being objectified, if you will. And so she refuses to do that. And so they end up taking this incident that happened within the king's household, really, at this party, and it becomes an empire-wide thing. You remember, in Esther chapter 1 and verse 1, it talks about, this is the Ahasuerus reign from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. When you sent the word out about something, it was going to go everywhere. And so that's what happens with this, is that they need to make sure, men, make sure you're in charge of your households. So she's banished from the king. She has her queenship taken away, and this edict goes out to all of the nation. And so after, likely in between chapter 1 and 2, we likely historically have this campaign against Greece, which fails. And so they're looking for a queen. His servants recommend, hey, you should find a new queen. And so we've got Mordecai and Esther introduced. And remember, Mordecai is from the family of Kish. This will be significant in a moment. Which, remember, he's going to be a distant cousin of Saul, Saul's family. So remember that as we go through. Esther starts off as this orphaned cousin. Both of her parents have passed away. Mordecai has been raising her. And you remember that Mordecai tells her from the beginning, don't tell them you're a Jew. And that's going to be part of the drama as we go on, as the reader and Mordecai and Esther know some details that the king doesn't know throughout this story, and those are going to come out as we go. And so we wrapped up last week talking about Esther finding favor with the king and some of the parallels to the Lord giving favor to Daniel, to Joseph, when they were in foreign nations and under foreign people. I think it's very likely here that what Esther engages in is not moral behavior. Some of that is a little bit debatable. But I think when we look at this story and see what's going on, that this is we do not see commendable behavior from Esther or Mordecai throughout the story of Esther. These are dynamic characters. These are people who stumble and fall, and the Lord is still going to use them to accomplish his purposes and to save his people. You'll remember that part of the drama of this story is that the Jews could possibly be wiped out here. Something that was pointed out as I was studying for tonight is that even though some of the Jews have returned from captivity under Zerubbabel already, if the command is given throughout the Persian Empire to kill all of the Jews, that means all of the Jews, not just the Jews that were still in captivity in Persia, because even though they were back in Judah, that was still part of the Persian Empire. They were still under that. And of course, when the Romans will take over, they'll be part of that empire, you know, the Greece and then Rome. So just remember that the thing that is at stake here is all of God's people, all of his chosen nation, wherever they are in the Persian Empire, which my understanding is they would all be in the Persian Empire at this time. So these are high stakes as we go into Haman's plot and into chapter 3 tonight. So let's open our Bibles together and let's read Esther chapter 3. Haman and Mordecai, which, oh, by the way, at the end of chapter 2, you just remember that also Mordecai discovered that plot against the king and saved the king's life. Again, foreshadowing of what we'll see more in just a moment. Esther chapter 3, beginning in verses 1 through 6. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. They told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's word would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So, we've got this brooding conflict between Haman and Mordecai. And this happens when the king promotes Haman. We're not sure exactly what all positions exactly he's holding throughout this, but he's lifted up above everybody else in the kingdom. And Haman is going through the streets and people are bowing and paying homage to him. There's some debate over what was the nature of this bowing and paying homage. Is this considered worship or is this just generally, you know, showing respect to your official here? I would say elected official, but they weren't really elected in those days. The king promoted Haman. That's how he got there. And so I'm inclined to think that it may not necessarily been a worship type of thing. Some people say, well, Mordecai, you know, refused to bow to him because this was a worship thing. That was a common practice in those days, to bow to someone without it necessarily being worship. Certainly if it was worship, he shouldn't have bowed down. But I think we're going to see something that goes farther back that I think also provides a reasonable explanation for why Mordecai doesn't bow to Haman. Because in some ways, it's going to be this interaction that sparks the rest of the story. And so that we want to ask the question, well, maybe why is this? I'll also say that whatever the reason is, it's not going to affect much the rest of the story. Whatever the reason was that Mordecai didn't bow to Haman, the rest of the story is going to happen in the way that it does. You'll note, where is Haman from as far as his lineage? Haman is from the house of Agag. He's an Agagite. And when we single that out, you remember King Agag, don't you? Is he was the king of the Amalekites, whom Saul was sent to utterly destroy. And Saul did a really good job with that, right? Of course, that's the instance in which King Saul went and destroyed all the people, except for the king and then the best of the animals. Oh, the people made me do it. And that whole instance where Saul didn't fear the Lord and take care of this. And so, of course, Samuel finishes the job. He hacks Agag to pieces later on in that story. But we know that it may be that the way this happened is the Amalekites were a nomadic people, and there may have well been various bands of the Amalekites. And so even though Agag himself was killed in that instance, though not by Saul, that there were some of either his family or those connected to Agag that were part of other bands that were not taken out in that one fell swoop. And so that's why you may still have some Agagites hanging around here, and including Haman, of course, the descendant of this. So you think back, you've got a man from the house of Kish and a man from the house of Agag. I mean, this bad blood goes way back between these two families, the Israelites and the Amalekites. And it wasn't just a personal thing, because Saul was told to destroy the Amalekites, but you go all the way back to Exodus. As the children of Israel are leaving the promised land, Exodus chapter 17 and verse 16, we're going to have the first real interaction between Israel and Amalek is when they come out and they attack them. Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim, verse 8. Skipping down to verse 16, after this, the Lord is going to place this curse on the people of Amalek. Exodus 17, verse 16, saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." And God keeps his promises. And so we've got this incident where Amalek attacked Israel as they were helpless coming out of the land of Canaan. And so God puts this curse on them, and that's just going to kind of follow through. And that was part of what God wanted Saul to do. Okay, Israel, you've got a king now. Go and take care of the Amalekites for what they did when you were coming out of the land of Egypt. And so Saul fails to do that in the way that he should, and you still got some Amalekites around. And here's Amalek, again, kind of a thorn in Israel's side so many years later, that here's this Agagite trying to wipe out the nation. You'll remember in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3, this is the connecting passage there, where God is telling Saul to go and destroy the people because of what Amalek did. There in 1 Samuel 15, in verse 3, it says, "Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and camel, sheep and donkey." And then verse 2, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. So now it's kind of interesting that God had commanded there to be this utter destruction of the people of Amalek. And now what's being threatened by the Agagite? The utter destruction of all of Israel. So it's kind of interesting to see that kind of reversed here Haman is seeking to do this. So we're going to see his plot unfold here. Coming back to Esther chapter 3, we'll read verses 7 through 11. "In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries.' So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, 'The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as seems good to you.'" Now, this is just an incredible plot that unfolds here that Haman is trying to take out. And it's kind of interesting how he starts this off. Haman does appear to be somewhat of a superstitious person. And so he casts lots here, which we see casting lots throughout the scripture as a way of telling what it is that God wants you to do. And it may be that the Lord guided this here. I'm not sure. It's interesting that they call the lots here Pur, which is where we get the name of that feast, Purim. It comes from this occasion where Haman casts these lots. Now, verse 7 is a little bit strange in the wording. I looked in some different translations. It appears that they cast lots. I don't know if it's the idea. They cast it several times until, because it makes it sound almost like they cast lots for 12 months. I think it's the idea they cast lots several times, and the lot falls on the 12th month of Adar, because we're going to see in chapter 9 and verse 1, that's when this takes place. So it's like Haman is trying to figure out, okay, what is the best time to take my vengeance on the Jews?
And let's cast lots for that. Let's see what the fates or the gods or whatever Haman's perspective on that was. He's trying to see what that was. But what this does for Israel is they're in the first month of the year when these things are taking place. That gives them about 12 months to prepare for this. And we're going to see that's going to be a great blessing to the people of Israel. So it may well be, like Proverbs 16 says, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. So it really well may be that the Lord has his hand in giving the Jews some time to be able to defend themselves. Of course, we're going to see what happens with the empire in that time, that they're able to have some help with that. So this is going to be carried out in the 12th month. And now, you look at the way that Haman does this. It reminds me a little bit of Nehemiah and some other people who have wisdom as they approach the king, but of course him, for sinister purposes. Haman goes to the king and says, well, there's this people, you know, in your land, and they've got different laws. And you know, king, it just doesn't do you any good to keep these people around. And what, of course, has Haman left out as he goes through this? He never actually says who it is. And Ahasuerus never asks who it is. That's what's amazing to me, is he just basically, he takes his signet ring off. And I'll tell you, if you lived in those days, that, you don't mess around with the signet ring. That is the king. It's like a blank check from the king. You can do whatever you want with the signet ring. It's the king's personal signature, so Haman could go and do whatever his heart desired to do with that signet ring. My understanding is they would carry that around, either wearing it on here, or they would keep, you know, some sort of seal with them, and even commoners would have something, but the king had a special signet ring to sign things with. You know, like they put the little wax on a message or whatever, you press your symbol into that wax, and so that's what the signet ring was. It's the sign of his authority, his signature, he's behind that. But basically what the king does is say, I'm not really going to make a decision. You take my signet ring, and you put my signature on whatever you do. I mean, that is kind of unilateral power that he's putting into Haman's hands right here. It's also interesting to note that there is something for the king in this. What does Haman offer the king? 10,000 talents of silver. If the calculations I heard were correct, that's about 300 tons of silver. That's a lot of money. So Haman obviously is in possession of this. Now, it may be that Haman doesn't have all that up front, but his idea is once they kill the Jews, they're going to plunder the Jews. So they'll be able to take all that revenue that they take from the Jews and then pay the king back from that. So the king is getting a very handsome price to annihilate these people, or just to let Haman go and annihilate these people. And so the king gives Haman his signet ring, gives him permission to do this thing. So let's read verses 12 through 15. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Now what's interesting here is the king's edict, the decree telling on the 13th day of the 12th month, this is the day when you get to slaughter all of the Jews in the kingdom. And that is an interesting day, because the decree goes out on the 13th day of the first month. You'll remember, on the first month and the 14th day is the day that Passover begins. And of course, Passover was commemorating what? God delivering his people out of the land of Egypt. When the greatest, you know, nation in the world was against Israel, not letting them go, oppressing them more and more. And so it's interesting that it's here kind of on Passover Eve that the king's edict goes out. And as the Jews would have been celebrating Passover in those next days, I think it would have called to mind,
you know, well, God rescued us, you know, back then. Can God rescue us again? And I think that may have been, you know, providential in some way that they're being reminded of God's deliverance even as they're in the most need of God's deliverance. I think this is an interesting thing to remember that's helpful for us. And it's also interesting that we remember God's deliverance for us every first day of the week. That whatever it is that we're going through, we can remember what God has done on our behalf for our sins. And that God can deliver us out of whatever else that he needs to deliver us out of. And so, of course, the chapter ends with the city being thrown into confusion. I mean, what's interesting about this is this was kind of this private encounter where Mordecai wouldn't, you know, bow down to Haman. The king's servants knew about it, and they had been telling, hey, Mordecai, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing this? And then they were the ones who went and told Haman. But it's this kind of personal thing that is now kingdom-wide. You know, all the Jews are about to be annihilated because of this personal encounter. So just briefly, I want us to look at, there's some interesting parallels between Esther 1 and what happened between the king Ahasuerus and Vashti, and chapter 3 with what happens between Mordecai and Haman. You'll remember that there's an independent person who defies the leader in the situation, Vashti in chapter 1 to the king, and Mordecai here to Haman. Both leaders are filled with wrath because of kind of an ego trip. Whatever it was, that they didn't like their orders not being followed, so they got really, really mad with what happened. The incident between just two people is going to expand to cover the entire empire in both instances. There's going to be an effort to punish all those in the same category. The edict is sent out about all the women in their homes and how men need to be, you know, in subjection. All the women are going to do the same thing, you know. And so we need to make sure they don't. And now, of course, you know, Mordecai, oh, he's a Jew. Let's destroy all the Jews in this instance. And then, of course, there's just decrees sent out by the Persian communication to the entire empire, 127 provinces that happens. So it's kind of interesting how chapter 1 has kind of set us up for what happens here in chapter 3. And again, just interesting to see the personalities that are involved, both in King Ahasuerus and in Haman, being similar figures as we kind of set this story up, although Haman seems to have a lot more initiative, at least for the most part, than King Ahasuerus does. So let's get into chapter 4 as we continue tonight. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. So, of course, as this edict goes out with the Persian version, I guess, of the Pony Express, they just goes everywhere, and as the Jews are getting their death sentence, really. Of course, there's just this mourning throughout the empire. But most notably, who is mourning here? Mordecai is, in a very public way, mourning this. And I don't know if Mordecai is particularly thinking, what have I done? You know, I didn't intend for my resistance to Haman to result in the death sentence for all of my nation. And if he feels kind of personally responsible for this. But Mordecai is in some ways kind of leading the way in the mourning here. And of course, these were common shows of sadness and deep mourning with the sackcloth, likely a rough material that they would put on, basically afflicting themselves, putting ashes or dust on their head. And so common signs of mourning in the ancient world that Mordecai is using here. So let's see Esther's reaction to this. Esther chapter 4, beginning in verse 4. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, and he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king and beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called in to come to the king these 30 days." So Esther hears that Mordecai is out making a scene in the middle of the city, and so she's like, "Mordecai, what's going on?" Before she even asks, what does she do? Kind of an interesting thing here. She sends him some new clothes. "Hey, what are you doing in sackcloth? You know, maybe you need some new clothes." I'm not exactly sure what this is, but she apparently doesn't know initially what has happened. It may have been that because she had hidden her identity as a Jewess, that no one had told her that there was this edict going out. But it's kind of an interesting situation that every Jew from India to Ethiopia seems to know what's going on, except for the Jew that happens to be in the king's palace. So it's just kind of interesting to see the way that information is circulating here, that Esther doesn't seem to know what's going on. Mordecai, on the other hand, seems to always know what's going on. I suspect the king didn't put the exact monetary amount he was offered in the edict that went out to all of the provinces. But Mordecai knows down to the dollar amount, you know, like what it is that Haman's paying the king to do this. Mordecai is very much in the know as we go through this. And so Mordecai, his reaction is, he's saying, "Listen, okay, I know this has been the plan up to this point, but you need to go to the king on behalf of your people. This is really a change in the plan up to this point. Mordecai's been saying, you keep your identity secret, you stay undercover right now, but now, okay, now it's time, you need to go to the king." And of course, Esther realizes, there's only one law. If I go in there and the king doesn't want to see me, that's it. If you look in those ancient pictures or reliefs, like the carvings of this thing, a lot of times, you know, who would you see in the king's presence? You know, there'd be the king, the guy, and then there'd be the guy standing there. What's he got? You know, he's got the big axe. That may likely have been to carry out, you know, if there's somebody there and king doesn't want to see you, you won't keep your head for very long after that. So the idea is that Esther knows, listen, I would be putting my very life in jeopardy to go say anything to the king. Now, you remember that Esther was made queen, but it is apparent that she's still part of the king's harem here, and he hasn't called for her in like a month, 30 days here. And so it's not like she's exactly in the king's best graces right now. It may have been that he's, you know, off with one of the other concubines, and they've kind of captured his attention right now. And so she's not in the best position to just waltz into the king's court and say, "Let my people go," kind of thing. And so she is in a very precarious position here. And so Mordecai is going to have some really important and challenging things to say to Esther. And Esther is going to have a really tough decision to make. Here's Mordecai's speech in verses 12 through 14. "And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, 'Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?'" Of course, this is the most famous verse in all of the book of Esther. But this really is kind of the moment of truth for Esther. And a lot of things hinge kind of on this moment in the book. Is Mordecai points out a couple of things to her. Number one, he says to Esther, "You know, I know you haven't, you know, let the king know that you're a Jew yet. But don't think that you're going to escape. If this edict goes into effect and they really do annihilate all the Jews, they're going to come and they're going to find you. Don't think that you'll escape just because you're in the palace. Your fate is tied in with the fate of your people in this instance." And he also points out, and this is where I think this just screams out God between the lines here, where Mordecai says, "If you keep silent, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." I just think we see Mordecai trusting in the Lord, because what other hope would Mordecai have? There doesn't seem to be a plan B here. There's no other place that Mordecai could have turned. This is a death sentence for the Jews unless the Lord comes in and intervenes. And he also mentions that even if deliverance comes in, you know, from another place, a.k.a. the Lord, then her and her household will be singled out. And again, I think that's him saying the Lord is going to see that you didn't stand up for your people, and the Lord's going to make sure you get taken care of, even if the people get saved. So I think there's no other good explanation for Mordecai's response other than that he trusts the Lord, and that the Lord is going to take care of his people and keep them from being wiped off the face of the earth. So that's just, I think, a really interesting response that Mordecai gives. And of course, he points out, listen, it may well be that this is the moment. All of the things, all the favor that you've been shown, all the good things that have led up to this moment in your life, it may well be that this is why you're here, for this moment, for such a time as this. And again, I think he may well be pointing to the Lord's hand in that, saying, listen, God has brought you here. What do you think he wants you to do? And I don't know how much time Esther took, because this is all happening kind of through messengers. Mordecai, of course, he's in sackcloth and ashes. He can't even come in the front door of the palace. And I don't know how long Esther really chewed on that. But you think about putting yourself in Esther's position there for a minute. I go in on the off chance that the king even lets me speak to him and maybe get a chance at saving my people. I don't even know if the king will listen. Or I just kind of like lay low and probably face death, you know, just a little bit down the line. I mean, maybe she thought she could escape. I don't know. But Esther has a decision to make, and she's the one who has to step up. No one can do it for Esther. She is in the only position of all of her people to be able to step into this role. And so we see Esther's response. Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So Esther makes this decision. And the first thing, it's interesting, the first thing that she asks for is, "I want you to fast on my behalf." And it's just notable that, again, you don't see prayer here. Some people interpret that to be that's how far away they've gotten from God at this point. But I suspect that in the midst here, fasting was always coupled with prayer in the Old Testament. They didn't just to fast. And I think it's notable that in three other books from around this time period, in the book of Ezra, in the book of Nehemiah, and in the book of Daniel, you see all three of those people, when there's these difficult situations, they are fasting and praying to the Lord. Even those, you know, remember, Daniel never came back that we know of. He was still in captivity. And so there are still devout people who are fasting and praying. I think that's what we see here, is that she's asking, listen, fast for me, and in essence asking, pray for me. Esther knows that she needs the Lord's help as she goes into this. And she says, okay, I'll do it. And if I die, I die. And I die doing what's right. And that type of resolve is just so inspiring to us, I think. So challenging to think about, here is someone who is willing to lay it all on the line for what she knows to be right with the people of God. And I want to wrap up the study tonight just talking about an application of this principle, kind of these do or die moments. And also, it's kind of a do and die moment, depending on the circumstance. But think about how many other people faced a decision like this one. There's Esther in Esther 4:16. I think it's interesting that the language here echoes from Genesis 43 and verse 14 with Jacob. When Jacob was told, listen, we have to take Benjamin back with us, or else we can't see the king, and we're all going to die. The famine's happening. We run out of food again. And when Jacob responds there, he says, just Go, may the Lord bless you. And if I'm bereaved of my children, I'm bereaved. And it's kind of in that moment that Jacob has to make that decision. He's lost Joseph, as far as he's concerned. And so here's the most precious son to him. And he has to bring himself to let go and to trust the Lord. And if the Lord wants to bring Benjamin back, the Lord can bring Benjamin back. And if he doesn't come back, he's willing to face the consequences, even if it doesn't come through. But he had to make that decision. You think about Daniel in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8, where Daniel made up his mind that he was not going to eat the king's choice food. And that, I don't know what the circumstances were when Daniel made that decision, but he may well have known that that decision could have cost him his life. Because the king's chief eunuch is going to say, I don't think that's such a good idea. But he says, give us 10 days, let's try this. But Daniel faces the same kind of decision, and he makes it knowing what could happen, but goes forward to do what's right. Of course, the epic moment in Daniel chapter 3 with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saying, listen, O king, you know, we don't need to give you an answer concerning this. If God wants to rescue us from the fiery furnace, he can rescue us. But even if he does not, we are not going to do what you're telling us to do and bow down to that golden image. And there's those moments where they had to make that decision and say, whatever happens, whether God saves us or whether God lets us be killed, we're going to do what's right. If we perish, we perish. And I think about Jesus in Luke 9 and verse 51, where it says that when the days drew near for him to go to Jerusalem, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And there's kind of that moment, and it's not in the heat of the moment always. Sometimes it's before the moment actually happens. But Jesus decides, he knows what's going to happen at Jerusalem. And Jesus sets his face and makes the decision, I'm doing it. I'm going. If I die, I die. In Jesus' case, he knew what it was. And he pleaded, Father, if possible, let this cup pass. But I'm going to do what I have to do to please the Lord. I think about Paul in Philippians chapter 3, when he knew all the things that he had to give up for the Lord, but he says, if by any means possible, I might attain to the resurrection from the dead. It doesn't matter what I have to do, it's worth it to get to the resurrection. And you know, isn't that the calling for us? When Jesus said, anyone who wants to follow after me has to take up his cross and follow me daily. God's asking us, it's kind of that do or die moment when you become a Christian, isn't it? Is you're making that decision before you know what's going to happen, if I perish, I perish. And say, really, I know that I'm going to perish. I'm taking up my cross. And I know that what's going to happen is going to be painful. You don't take up your cross to have an easy journey with an easy end. But you know that when you do what the Lord wants you to do and you speak up, that the Lord will see it through in the end. And like we've talked about this morning, we've taken up our cross. And in this country, in our families, and in different situations, we're going to be called on in these kind of moments. Let's be those people like Esther and say, listen, I don't know what's going to happen. Pray for me. But I will go. If I perish, I perish. But I will go. And that's the invitation tonight, isn't it? Is you have the decision before you tonight. If you are not yet a Christian, there's coming a day when all those who do not follow the Lord will be cut off. That there is a death that is coming to all those outside of God's will. And you have the choice. You can wait, like Esther could have waited to see what was going to happen. Or you can make the decision to say, I'm going to go. And whatever happens to me, but I know that this is what I've got to do. And you can make that decision tonight. You can be baptized for the remission of your sins, repenting of those sins, saying, I'm not walking it that way anymore. And if you're here tonight and you know that you haven't been walking the way that you should walk, and again, it's kind of that do or die moment. Am I going to take up my cross again and do what I know I need to do and make things right? Or am I going to keep trying my chances, waiting on it?
The invitation is extended to all who need it tonight. If there's any way we can help you to be right with God, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.